I tried three times to become a monk, and I was finally ordained properly in Bayagiri in California in 2012, after spending a couple of years there as an Anacharaka and as a Seminara and as a layperson. And so I've been living now in monasteries for a little over 7 years, and this last rains retreat, I finished up my fifth rains, and so now technically I'm independent. I've finished my dependence in this tradition. A monk is reckoned to be a kind of a monk in training. Like a monk who's dependent upon a teacher. And it's an interesting term, dependence, since it kind of implies, you might say something like incompetence even, not up to speed yet, needs training wheels. So, which is not a pejorative sort of thing, it's more recognizing the reality that a monk needs to learn is fairly substantial and takes a while to pick it up, and it's not something that you can learn from books. So you actually do need a teacher. So after your fifth rains retreat, you're sort of free to go in this tradition. You can go other places. So here I am working my sixth rain retreat. Here I am doing winter retreat with Ajahn Punidamo here at Arrow River, and I'm very happy to be here. So, I was thinking about what kind of a Dhamma talk to give. And Ajahn Chah gave the instruction to his monks to not do any formal preparation for a Dhamma talk. Don't take notes and build up a bunch of speaking points and that sort of thing. Just sort of spontaneously let the Dhamma flow through you. But, that said, I've been doing a lot of reading lately. I've been rereading the Anguttara Nikaya and the Sanyutta Nikaya. And in the back of my mind, I've had this long-standing fascination or concern or preoccupation with the idea of ethics in human life. What's the purpose of ethical behavior? How does it bear on the human condition? Why is it so prominent in so many cultures? And so one of the themes that I've been pursuing in the Anguttara Nikaya and elsewhere is this dual term called hiri otapa. And hiri and otapa, the Buddha calls them the guardians of the world. They are the moral fear and moral dread of wrongdoing. And the idea of fear of wrongdoing has to do with not the consequences of having done wrong, the sort of bad things that could happen to you because you do something wrong. And the dread of wrongdoing has something along the flavor of what good people would think about you if they knew that you were doing this bad thing. So if one has moral fear and moral dread, hiri and otapa, then one won't transgress one's own training rules. So it's an interesting idea. I think it's actually very central, very important, because and that's part of the reason the Buddha gave us these training rules. So there's these five training precepts for lay people. There's eight training precepts for people who are staying at monasteries. There's 10 for samaneras, that's novice monks. And there's 227 for bhikkhus, and then there's 300 and something for the nuns. All these rules are reckoned as not rules in the sense of laws, like you'll be punished somehow by some external authority if you transgress these rules. that rules are all reckoned as training rules. They're something that you use as a guideline to determine what you should do in any given circumstance, how to conduct yourself, how to comport yourself. And if you have if you have a sense of hiri and otapa, then, for example, if you're a monk, there's a rule, a very minor rule, against looking in another monk's bowl in order to pass judgment. And so, even if you happen to glance into another monk's bowl, part of you kind of recoils at the idea of judging the other monk because he took too much, or his taste in food is different than your taste in food. What you think, you know, like what you think of a healthy meal and what he thinks he should eat are two different things. That whole judging mind will grab at anything that somebody else is doing and pass judgment. And there's a rule that says you're not supposed to do that. And so I actually make it a practice to not look in other people's bowls because I'm afraid my mind will pass judgment. So this is hiri, this is otapa. It's not so much that I'm afraid of what other people will say, although if you do transgress a rule as a monk, you are obliged to confess it every 2 weeks. So somebody else has to know that you've transgressed this rule. But what I have seen in my own practice is how any little faults that I allow to creep into my conduct, they're like the nose of the camel in a tent. This idea that, you know, if you're a desert traveler and you've got this camel and you set up your tent and it's cold outside and the camel puts his nose in the tent in order to feel some of the warmth of the tent, you know, if you allow that to continue, the camel will soon get its whole body in the tent. So you have to watch very carefully and nip things in the bud, as it were, before they get out of hand. So in pursuing this theme, I came across a very nice sutta that I thought was stuck in my mind, and I wanted to talk about it. It's in the Anguttara Nikaya, in the Book of the Eights. So the Anguttara Nikaya is a collection of suttas. The collection is composed by in terms of the numerical items that are in the sutta. So there's a whole book in this collection, the Book of the Ones, which are all suttas about just one thing. And then there's the Book of Twos, the Book of Threes, the Book of Fours. So like in the Book of Fours, you would have things like the Four Right Efforts and the Four Noble Truths. In the Book of Fives, you'd find the Five Fifth Spiritual Powers. And so there'd be suttas about things that just happen to be four of something or eight of something. So this is the Book of Eights. And the sequentially, the suttas themselves are not, they don't follow any theme other than that numerical theme. So this is sutta number two in the Book of the Eights, and the title is Wisdom. So it's the eight things that have to do with wisdom, you could say. The preceding sutta was the eight benefits of the practice of loving kindness. So you can see there was quite a change from one theme to another, but they both have eight things in common, the fact that they both have eight in them. This is one of those suttas where there's really no particular setting. It just starts right off with the Buddha saying, bhikkhus, monks, I will teach you the eight causes for the obtaining of the wisdom which is fundamental to the spiritual life, and for the increase, growth, maturation, and fulfillment through development of that same spiritual wisdom by one who has obtained it. Listen. And the monks say, okay, we'll listen. So he enumerates this list of eight things. And the first item in the list, number one, is a bhikkhu or a practitioner, a monk, a nun, a laywoman or a layman who's serious about the practice, But of course, he's addressing the monks, so he speaks in terms of monks, but it really applies to anybody who's serious about the practice. A bhikkhu dwells in dependence on a teacher or teachers and holds him or her with respect and reverence, developing a strong sense of hiri and otapa in regard to that person. In other words, that's the wise person in their life to whom they refer to in their mind when they ask themselves whether they should do something or not. In other words, so if they're thinking about kicking a cat or something like that, doing something harmful, they would think to themselves, what would my teacher think if they saw me doing this? They wouldn't do anything that they think their teacher would disapprove of. So this taking of dependence on the teacher, it's interesting that they use the word dependence. It's more, it doesn't have the sense of being like needy, in the sense of like I don't know how to take care of myself in the world. I need someone to feed me. I need someone to look after my clothing. Like a child is a dependent. It has more the sense of reliance on somebody who is a reference for one's own spiritual practice. And notice that this is the very first item in the list. So here's this list of eight things that cause the obtaining of wisdom that's fundamental to the spiritual life. And the very first one is to dwell dependent upon a teacher or teachers for towards whom one has a strong sense of hiri and otapa, moral shame and moral dread, against wrongdoing, and for whom one feels respect, reverence, and affection. So it's like someone that you respect and that you like, as well as hold in high esteem and high regard. That's number one. So you hear this a lot in spiritual circles, that one should have a teacher. And so this shows up in this list as the very first item. The second item is from time to time that practitioner approaches their teacher or teachers with any questions, doubts, or misunderstandings they might have about the Dhamma. And those venerable ones then clarify what's been obscure. They allay any doubts. They dispel perplexity regarding those points from which perplexity may arise. In other words, they explain everything regarding the Dhamma to the practitioner, so that the practitioner really has all their confusion cleared up. So this is actually the key role of the teacher, is to help explain the Dhamma, because the Dhamma that's presented in the suttas or in the books, it's words and sentences and it makes sense, but when it comes right down to it, the Dhamma is something that you do. It's something that you practice. And so because it's an actual undertaking of mind and body, it is best done by following the example and getting instruction directly from another person. Hence the teacher or teachers. The third item in the list of eight. So the first is to have a teacher. The second one is to approach the teacher and ask questions about the Dhamma. The third one is to, having learned that Dhamma, that practitioner then withdraws from, takes that Dhamma and withdraws with it, both in body and mind, from concerns and entanglements in the world. So I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but the sense of that item is that the Dhamma becomes that practitioner's key concern, the foremost involvement of their mind, and they use their time to pursue it. So this is, again, is for the obtaining of wisdom. It's not for other purposes. It's to obtain wisdom. So that's number three. They withdraw in body and mind. Number four is temporarily slipping my mind. Hang on a second, let's see. Number three, withdraws. Number four. I'm sure it'll come back to me. So number five is this practitioner has learned much. So for the obtaining of wisdom, he or she has learned the Dhamma. By much, they mean like has gotten a pretty good grip on the central points of the doctrine. So understands about the aggregates, the sense bases, dependent origination, and this is in an intellectual level and deeper. So the phrasing in this sutta is something like he learns it, memorizes it, recites it, turns it over in his mind, and penetrates it well by view. He understands it thoroughly. So this is actually a pretty good, another good justification for spending some time actually memorizing some of the lists of the Dhamma. Understanding the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Noble Path, the Seven Factors of Enlightenment, the Five Aggregates, the Six Sense Spheres, the 12 Links of Dependent Origination. These are all things that were made as lists, and obviously for the purpose of memorization. And in order to make the memory useful, it's first one thing is to load it into memory, and another is to turn it over in your mind and try to see how it all connects together, how one thing relates to another, how it all fits together as a comprehensive whole. And so this is the idea of penetrating it well with one's own mind. The one with this degree of understanding is in a place then to actually understand their own experience. So when something comes up in their practice, because they have the doctrine in their mind, they're much more likely to interpret their experience in a way that's framed by their Dhamma understanding, rather than by all the other different ways they could possibly understand any given experience. So that's the fifth factor. Then the sixth one is energy. So this practitioner undertakes to very energetically undertakes to dispel any unwholesome states which have arisen, energetically undertakes to avoid the arising of unarisen unwholesome states, to arouse wholesome states that have not yet arisen, and to sustain wholesome states that have arisen. So these are the four right efforts. That's the sixth factor for the arousing of wisdom, the obtaining of wisdom. The seventh factor is a little interesting because of its placement. It is, it goes that in the midst of the Sangha, this practitioner does not engage in pointless speech and rambling talk. This is an interesting point because it kind of occurs late in the list. It's not like number one, but it's not unimportant. Pointless speech and rambling talk. Of course, one's speech tends to reflect the concerns that one has. And pointless speech and rambling talk, I think, is synonymous for this. Kind of a canonical list of unedifying topics for discussion. And this list of unedifying topics includes kings and ministers and robbers and wars and heroes and gossip and vehicles and garlands and relatives and houses. And it's just kind of this whole list of things that the canon has as what people talk about when they're wasting their time talking. It's not that these things have no place at all, but that one who's really intent on developing this wisdom, when they're in the midst of other practitioners, in the midst of the Sangha, they don't waste their own time or other people's time by rambling on about pointless things. This is a little bit different than refusing to talk about anything other than Dhamma topics. Even when the Buddha would be approached by a king or a wanderer, somebody who wanted to ask him a question, there would always be some cordial and courteous talk that would happen first. The sort of thing like, how's your health and how's your family, that sort of thing. Just a way of connecting socially with people is normal and okay. So but the rule has to do with the spirit or the attitude that a person brings to their practice when they're with other spiritual practitioners. Their orientation becomes one of either speaking words of Dhamma, asking for words of Dhamma, or if neither one of those is appropriate, observing or not shunning noble silence is the way the phrase goes. Not shunning noble silence. And that's the seventh. And then the eighth, interestingly, this is the last one. It might be the most important one, but it's interesting that all these other things come beforehand. So the last one is, he or she abides observing the arising and passing away of the five aggregates. So the five aggregates, of course, are the five aggregates subject to clinging. So it's the aggregate of form subject to clinging, which is primarily refers to the body, but really the whole universe of form, those things that we can interact with our bodies. Feeling, which is the affect of that contact has on us, either pleasant, painful, or neutral. Those are the three kinds of feeling, and each sense door will create sensory inputs that have one of those three feelings associated with them continuously. Form, feeling, perception, the recognition of sense objects, mental formations, which is thinking about or formulating about sense objects, and then consciousness itself. So these five aggregates, when they're seen as they arise and seen as they pass away, this is the eighth cause of the arising of wisdom. And this, again, is the wisdom that's fundamental to the spiritual life. So all those other things are necessary, too. They're earlier on in the list. The fifth one is the one that it's kind of like the capstone. If you try to jump straight to the fifth one, or the last one, without laying the groundwork, then you may not get the results that you're looking for. The wisdom that's being spoken about here, it's called the wisdom that's fundamental to the spiritual life, is insight into the true nature of phenomenon, which is why the eighth item on the list has to do with seeing the arising and passing away of the aggregates. The insight that arises from seeing this clearly, seeing this with the right view. And that right view is developed, of course, by having a teacher and asking questions about Dhamma and studying and learning and memorizing and reciting and penetrating well in one's own mind what one has learned, spending time withdrawn from engagement, not occupying the mind with idle chatter. Hanging out with noble friends and noble companions. These things all end up being included in that list. But finally, when one sits down and contemplates arising and passing away of phenomena, then this very wisdom that's being spoken about here can be obtained. So that wisdom and insight, and the way this sutta phrases it is that these eight these eight items help bring about the obtaining of the wisdom which is fundamental to the spiritual life, and bring about, and one who's obtained it, bring about the maturation, the growth, the development, and the fulfillment through development of this same wisdom. So the even one who's already develop some wisdom, that same cycle of having a teacher and inquiring about the Dhamma that keeps applying all the way up until the until wisdom is completely fulfilled. So it's worthwhile to have a sutta like this as a guideline for how to conduct one's practice if there's things that are not quite up to snuff in terms of, say, hiriyotapa or actually asking questions about the Dhamma, things that you don't quite understand, just trying to figure everything out by yourself but not taking advantage of the teacher. And number four just came back to me. I almost missed it. So the along with having taken dependence on a teacher, or having a teacher, basically, that one depends on, one is relying on, asking that teacher question, taking the Dhamma that one learns and going and withdrawing from time to time from entanglement and other affairs. Number four is he or she is virtuous and conducts themselves virtuously and in line with their training precepts, whatever they are. So again, it comes back to ethics. The person avoids doing anything that would transgress their precepts, and he or she sees danger in the slightest fault. And that's an important point. The whole idea of the camel's nose in the tent again. If you're that serious about the practice, you're trying to bring about this wisdom, it's grounded in a very careful, mindful, moment-to-moment, day-by-day, hour-by-hour, paying attention to what you're doing with your mind, your body, and your speech. And at the very least, not letting yourself do or say things which go against your precepts. And if anything does happen, you do say or do anything, that catches your attention right away and that you see the fault in it and you try to correct it. If you're doing that, then your conduct will tend to get better and better over time. And of course, that the mindfulness that's required to do that will stand you in good stead when it comes time to sit down and actually meditate, try to practice and see the arising and passing away of phenomena in the five aggregates. So again, in many ways, we see in the Dhamma this intersection between what's called sila and samadhi and panya. So in this particular sutta from the Anguttara Nikaya, the eight factors of wisdom, the eight factors that give rise to wisdom, wisdom would be panya in the sila, samadhi, panya reckoning of the Eightfold Noble Path. Sila being virtue, samadhi being mindfulness and concentration or meditation, and panya being wisdom. And it's actually the wisdom that we're after. Everything else is a means to an end in a way, but the panya, the wisdom, is the thing that needs to be seen in order for the path to be fulfilled. The Buddha's offer, the thing that he's proposing, is that contained in the Four Noble Truths, is that human life, the way we experience it ordinarily, is characterized by unsatisfactoriness. And that unsatisfactoriness can be seen as caused by clinging and craving, and the unsatisfactoriness can be brought to an end. And that there's a way to do this. That's the Eightfold Noble Path. So the Four Noble Truths contain very clearly what the Buddha is offering, which is the end of unsatisfactoriness, the end of suffering. And the way that comes about is through seeing with wisdom how things are. So the wisdom that we're trying to develop in our practice is the very wisdom that's being spoken about in this sutta, which is labeled as fundamental to the spiritual life. So it's insight into the nature of causality. And there's a lot of groundwork that one has to lay in order for that to work out. And this sutta is a very good framework for understanding one's own practice and how this wisdom can be brought about. So I'll offer that for reflection today.